Previously on Beta.
You know what my husband said about the news? He called it the first rough draft of history.
Do you get muscle spasms for no reason? Do your past failures bother you? Would you like to be told what to do? Do you find interest in other people? Are you often consumed by envy? Are you scientific in your thought? Are you usually truthful to others? Are you unpredictable?
And now, we adopted a little girl who's a gluten.
Uh-huh.
So, free the gluten.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, musician and producer Warren Zanes on his Tom Waits tribute album, Come On Up to the House, Women Sing Waits.
And if you are a singer-songwriter, it's almost inevitable that you've spent some time trying to figure out what is the magic in this potion that Tom Waits has been cooking up for so many years.
And White Negros author Lauren Michelle Jackson on appropriating Black pop culture.
The way that memes circulate and change themselves and sort of reinvent owes such a debt to the way that Black people move and change and reinvent culture.
That's all coming up later in the show.
The target of his joke was nobody, really. A notoriously soft, contact-phobic NBA player who would be starting the season on the injured list. My question is, Pepper said with flawless comic pause, how long does a guy usually stay on the injured list for a hysterectomy? Maybe if he hadn't taken a moment to reword the joke in his head, Pepper would have noticed an unfamiliar reporter among the group. A young ex-jock-looking guy with a thick neck, patchy beard, and 2.7 million Instagram followers, busily snapping photos, thumbing his cell phone, and sharing the joke with an angry world.
That's Peter Melman reading an excerpt from his novel, Me As Well. The book is about a veteran sports columnist named Arnie Pepper, who cracks a joke that goes viral, threatening his job and his reputation. It's a Seinfeldian satire about oversensitivity in our culture. That would make sense since Peter also co-executive produced and wrote for the iconic sitcom. He's responsible for such Seinfeld-esque phrases as double-dipping, sponge-worthy, and yada, yada, yada. Peter joined us to talk about the glory days of Seinfeld and what inspired him to write this novel.
A whole bunch of things inspired me, but initially it was reading an obituary of Philip Roth. And he was talking about when he wrote Portnoy's Complaint. And I was thinking, like, what could I get as obsessed about as Philip Roth got about his mother? Mm. And the only thing I could come up with was sports, because I have this big sports background and I have a very combative relationship with sports. You know, I can't really stand the fans and the microphones and the conversation that goes on around sports. And then the story kind of dripped off into other things that are fascinating to me, like journalism, the fact that you can't tell a joke anymore, you know, with my comedy background.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, I would have had 90 Seinfeld lines that would have been unacceptable now.
At least, maybe and, more.
Yeah. And I'm also fascinated by the day-to-day lives of the people who have been nailed by the Me Too movement. You know, I'm just fascinated by wondering if Matt Lauer can go out to lunch.
Mm. And interesting that you say day-to-day, because one of the most fascinating things, one of the things that makes Me As Well work so well, I think, is the fact that it just unfolds over the course of 2 days. So there's this real sense of urgency.
Yeah, I always like keeping things in a really tight time frame because, you know, it helps you focus on what the main character's thoughts are.
Yes.
You know, especially when your main character is in the center of a media storm like this, it's very ripe because, you know, emotions and thoughts just pinball off each other like bumper cars, to mix a metaphor.
Yeah, yeah, Yeah. One reviewer has described Me As Well as a, quote, send-up of the Me Too movement, end quote. Do you agree with that description?
I actually don't totally agree with that. You know, I mean, there is a certain hyper-reality to the book, but I think I'm trying at least to objectively look at the Me Too movement and the dangers therein. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot to agree, obviously. There's a lot to agree about and with the Me Too movement. But, you know, like every movement, there are those wings of the movement where it just goes a little bit too far and a little too over the top. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the danger is always there for that kind of expansion to happen whenever there's a movement of any kind.
Yeah. I couldn't help but notice the Wisconsin in your novel. Arnie attended the University of Wisconsin here in Madison, and he served as the editor-in-chief of the Badger Herald student newspaper. Is there any particular reason that you had Arnie go to college here in Madison?
You know, interestingly enough, Wisconsin was one of the colleges that I considered going to. Hmm. When I went to University of Maryland, and, you know, I grew up in New York, and I had skipped a grade, and my mom didn't want me to go quite that far away. So I wound up at the University of Maryland with no regrets. But I always held a special spot in my heart for Wisconsin. I don't know why, but there was something about that school and the town of Madison that, you know, when I was applying to colleges, I was thinking, God, that looks so nice. Everything about it looks so great. Mm. I would love to go there. So as another example of an alternate reality in my life as opposed to Arnie Pepper's life, I made him a Wisconsin grad.
Mm, very cool. Very nice. Yeah. This is your second novel. I'm curious, how has your journalism experience and your writing for Seinfeld helped you as a novelist?
Well, Seinfeld was really helpful as far as just understanding what dramatic structure is all about. Mm. And, you know, making a story interesting and getting out of the gate fast. You know, like, I always remembered that in an editing room at Seinfeld, if the first act of the episode felt like it went by in a minute and a half, you knew it was a great episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you got to the first commercial and you felt, oh my God, it's the commercial already?
Yeah.
That was a great episode. So that bit of structuring really helped. And of course, you know, you learn different kinds of humor from all different fields. You know, even Howard Cosell was an incredibly funny guy.
Yeah.
I used to kid Jerry Seinfeld that he was the second funniest boss I ever had.
He probably didn't like that, did he? Or did he take it in good spirit?
He actually loved, he loved those. I would tell Howard Cosell stories, and he goes, you got to do a one-man show.
Yeah.
And, you know, and journalism, you know, also helps the book because it forces you to notice people and their actions and start looking into the motivations for those actions. You know, just looking behind the scenes of everything.
Yeah.
You know, you really learn to look deeply into everything and not take things at face value, which really helps when you're building a character.
If, nay, when, the movie based on Me As Well gets the green light, who should play Arnie Pepper? Peter Melman?
Well, I think he would do a great job.
I think so, too.
I don't know how many tickets he's going to sell. I mean, you know, I'd have to go with Brad Pitt.
Okay. That was a very good choice. That was interesting how you started that talking about it. Well, it's partly because I did it in the third person, but then you went in the third person. It reminded me of the Seinfeld episode, The Jimmy.
God, it's so funny. I remember that that Jimmy spoke in the third person.
Jimmy doesn't like misunderstandings.
Yeah, well, what happened was
Jimmy and misunderstandings kind of clash.
At this point, I can barely remember, like, what stories were going with what episodes. You know, I remember the Jimmy part, but I don't remember anything. I can't exactly place everything else that was going on in that particular episode. Even in the episodes I wrote sometimes, I'm a little bit like, what was Kramer doing in that one? I don't remember.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, there's a lot
remember.
To keep. Yeah, there's a lot to keep track of because it was so well written and so dense. And what I was surprised to learn, I only learned this recently while preparing for this interview, that unlike pretty much every other sitcom, Seinfeld didn't use a writer's room in which writers would typically gather together and collaborate on jokes and lines. Do you think that that not having a writer's room helped make Seinfeld distinctive because you and your fellow writers didn't feel the pressure to dumb it down for some mass bonehead audience?
I absolutely think that. You know, the fact is, you were writing your scripts to please Jerry and Larry. I was attending all the episodes just so I could be ready for the next season when I was brought on staff. And I remember watching that episode when Jerry and Elaine try to maintain their friendship while having sex.
What if we did?
What if?
Is that like the end of the world or something?
Certainly not.
Why shouldn't we be able to do that once in a while if we want to?
I know!
I mean, really, what is the big deal? We go in there, we're in there for a while, and then come back down here. It's not complicated.
It's almost stupid if we didn't.
It's moronic.
Absurd!
I just thought this was the most beautifully written, perfect scene I'd ever seen in TV. And, you know, that's not the kind of scene that's really going to come out of a group writing environment.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the whole concept of, you know, the writer's room, is a misnomer because you're not writing. You're basically selling jokes.
Yeah.
You're shouting out jokes. You're kind of like an overpaid Willie Loman.
Yeah.
And it flattens out the material. You know, the fact is, you know, when you're writing alone, you have to keep in mind, you know, Larry's voice, because it's his show.
Yes.
You know, and the fact that I wrote for so many different kinds of magazines, you know, like one week I'm writing for a women's magazine, then I'm writing for the Village Voice, then the New York Times, then GQ, was very helpful for me because I was able to adjust my writing voice a little bit.
Mm.
And I actually think that Seinfeld was probably the only show that I could have been successful on because, you know, you did have to do it mostly yourself. You had to come up with ideas for all four of the characters, pitch those ideas to Larry and Jerry, and if they liked an idea or, you know, you would have, you know, oh, I like that Elaine idea. I don't like that George idea. I like the other George idea, though.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you would have to mash them together and try to find a string that would connect an entire script. And it was, you know, it was very difficult and very rewarding when it worked and, you know, kind of depressing when it didn't.
Yeah. I met this lawyer. We went out to dinner. I had the lobster bisque. We went back to my place. Yada, yada, yada. I never heard from him again.
But you yada, yada over the best part.
No, I mentioned the bisque.
You wrote some of the most famous and memorable and funniest episodes of Seinfeld during your time working on the show as a writer, producer, and co-executive producer, yada, 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 including the yada, yada, which you co-wrote with Joel Franklin. Where did this phrase come from?
Amazingly enough, in about 10 years before I wrote the episode, I had had a lunch with an editor in New York. And I noticed that twice she used the phrase yada yada, and I'd never heard that before. And I just thought, huh, that's odd. And then, like, it came to me, like, 9 years later. Somehow I remembered that, and I was thinking, boy, you could really cover up all forms of sin by saying yada 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 in the middle of a story.
Yeah.
And I just thought, wow, this is a great idea. And then I already had this other idea. You know, my best friend is a converted Jew. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he made a Jewish joke to me once, and I had this thought, like, God, I wonder how long it took him to feel comfortable doing that. And then I was thinking, well, if he did it the next day, it would be really funny.
Anyway, I wanted to talk to you about Dr. Whatley. I have a suspicion that he's converted to Judaism purely for the jokes.
And this offends you as a Jewish person?
No, it offends me as a comedian.
And the funny thing about that whole script is I always thought that anti-dentite was going to be the thing that catches on.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was yada yada.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, by that time, I was a little bit more aware of the possibility that these things could catch on because, you know, I didn't think that when, you know, with Spongeworthy or Shrinkage or Double Dip, you know, and they all kind of took off, you know, just... And, you know, I didn't think in terms of creating a catchphrase. I just thought in terms of coming up with a word that describes the situation, and somehow it all caught on.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word spongeworthy, which is featured in another iconic Peter Melman episode called The Sponge. What's the origin story behind this episode?
I love that one, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
I was driving. I was driving in my car listening to National Public Radio when I heard a report that the Today Sponge was going out of business. And immediately I had this thought, like, what if Elaine is a sponge user? She would probably try to have to stock up before they run out. But she'd only be able to get a limited number, which would, you know, change her entire screening process for who she sleeps with.
Yes, I think I'm sponge-worthy. I think I'm very sponge-worthy.
Run down your case for me again.
Well, we've gone out several times. We obviously have a good rapport. Mm-hmm. I own a very profitable electronics distributing firm. I eat well. I exercise. Blood tests, immaculate. Mm-hmm.
You gonna do something about your sideburns?
Yeah, there? I told you.
Now, that was the only time in all my years at Seinfeld that an entire story came to me in one thought. That used to happen to Larry David, you know, every other day. But that was the only time when it happened for me. But I love that episode, and I love the part about the not wearing the AIDS ribbon.
What's it going to be? Are you going to wear the ribbon?
No, oh, never.
But I'm wearing the ribbon. He's wearing the ribbon. We are all wearing the ribbon. So why aren't you going to wear the ribbon?
This is America. I don't have to wear anything I don't want to wear.
What are we going to do with him?
I guess we're just going to have to ditch him. To wear the ribbon.
When we took shots at our own liberalism, it was always very gratifying. You know, like in Larry Charles' episode where with the outing, when they kept on saying, not that there's anything wrong with it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I love that, you know, because we're taking shots at our own ultra-leftist feelings in life, you know, so, you know.
Yeah, you've described your Seinfeld career as a nonstop struggle to learn how to be creative. So I'm curious about what the most important things you learned about creativity were from your experience working on Seinfeld, writing for the show.
I think two things. First, I noticed that Los Angeles, or Hollywood as a whole, has this terrible case of first thought-itis. You know, they, whatever their first thought is, they think that that it's absolutely brilliant.
First thought,
so
best
one thing
thought.
I learned is, you know what? Take a little while and think about whether you can do better. Now, the second thing, and the more important one, is that I think all of us have 50 thoughts a day that are interesting, and they fly in and out of our heads.
Yeah.
And you have to build up some kind of mechanism to, you know, lead an existential life and have your thoughts go through your head, but somehow catch them when they're good. And that was, you know, what I really kind of envied at first about Larry, because he was very, very tuned into his own thoughts. And, you know, it took me a while to get there. And, you know, being creative as opposed to being a journalist is, you know, a real opposite kind of thing, because, you know, as a journalist, you're looking out at the world and reporting on it. But, you know, a lot of creativity is looking within your own head and making up the world based on that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's creativity is a really tricky thing. And, you know, I'm kind of happy about the fact that, you know, I still deal with it. I still, you know, struggle with it. And, you know, it's a good thing to struggle with. I'm sure, you know, John Updike was struggling with creativity till, you know, the day he died.
Yeah. So what's next for Peter Melman? I'm guessing it's going to be Jerry Seinfeld's idea of the one-man show, An Evening with Peter Melman, especially when you're prepping for it already by doing stand-up. What do you think?
To tell you the truth, since I finished the novel, I've been at a little bit of a loss for what's next. I'm trying to figure it out. I do come out with the occasional, you know, new joke or something like that. And, you know, I shove it into stand-up and think, what can I do with all this?
One man show, Peter. One man show.
Yeah, that's how many people will show up.
Yeah. There you go. Peter Melman, thank you very much.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
Peter Melman is the author of Me As Well. He's also a former writer and co-executive producer for Seinfeld. Find out more about Peter at WPR.com/beta.
The number one goal was to wrap up a birthday present and hand it to Tom Waits on his 70th. That was the whole thing. And just to say, man, we came together as a group to tell you how much you mean to us.
Musician and producer Warren Zanes on the Tom Waits tribute album featuring some of today's top women artists. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Tom Waits has one of the most distinctive voices in music. Trouser Press once described it as a gravelly, smoke-scratched rasp that crosses Joe Cocker and Louis Armstrong at the end of a particularly bad bender. So it would be impossible for women to cover his songs, right? Wrong. Musician and producer Warren Zanes compiled a Tom Waits tribute album called Come On Up to the House, Women Sing Waits. It features many great performers, including Patti Griffin, Amy Mann, and Roseanne Cash. Our colleague and senior Tom Waits correspondent, Roz Gryard, caught up with Warren to find out more about the collection.
The moment that that recording came in, you know, Joseph's Come On Up to the House, I felt like something about, you know, how I felt about the spirit of the project was embodied in their recording. And there's something about, and I'm projecting all kinds of elements, no doubt, but that Come On Up to the House felt like a particularly kind of maternal moment to me. There was something about, you know, the best side in my life of femininity has often been those moments when I'm lost and I'm wounded and somebody sees it and says, come on up to the house and let's see if we can get some healing done. You know, that's the way I took it. And I thought, God, that's such a good sentiment. And I feel, you know, when we put these songs in the hands of female artists, I just felt that spirit increase. And it's a free-floating thing that it goes beyond gender, but in my associations, I associated more with a female spirit. So that song, when I was sequencing, I'm like, God, I think this has to be the first song. And the more I worked on the sequence, the more central that recording became. And then I thought, wow, this is the title.
Well, the moon is broken and the sky is cracked. Come on up to the house. The only thing you can see is all that you lack. Come on up to the house. All your crying don't do no good. Come on up to the house. Come down off the cross. We can use the wood. You gotta come on up to the house.
The material tells you. The material has its own pulse. And in this case, the material told me. And I took it to Scott Robinson. He said, yeah, that's the title. And that's the vibe.
How did this all come together as far as the artists? Did you select the artists that would be involved?
I worked with Scott and he allowed me to dream. And I've done multi-artist projects in the past. And I knew at the outset that you ask 100 to get 10.
Yeah.
And so you can create your wish list, but what you end up with will never reflect that original list. A few people did. But the interesting thing for me was that it being Tom Waits who was being honored, recognized, whatever word you might use, the percentage of takers was much higher, which was a beautiful thing about the project. But there were some, you know, there were the ones that got away. I really had a dream of Patti Smith doing What's He Building in There. I wanted Chrissy Hynde doing 16 Shells from a 30-06.
That's awesome.
Regina Spektor was one that I talked to. Stevie Nicks, she was on my very first list, but they were just getting ready to go on the road, and Lindsey Buckingham had been, an exit had been created for him, mm-hmm. and Mike Campbell and Neil Finn had come into the band, so obviously they were very, very busy. But in some cases, it's not because they don't love Waits as much as the next person, but it's maybe they can't find the song that feels like theirs as it comes out of them. But we did have a high rate of people coming back, and the beauty is these kind of things, it's the gods are looking down, and they're going to tell you what it's going to be in the end.
I love that. So almost all of the musicians on the album are folk and country artists, with the exception of Corinne Bailey-Ray, whose roots are more in soul and pop music. Was that an intentional choice, or was that, again, just what the gods gave you?
With Corinne Bailey-Ray, yeah, she's a little more over in a kind of pop, soul, jazz territory. And in that case, I just had this idea of Jersey Girl in her hands. And the thing that I love the most is that I really wanted her to not change the gender pronouns. I wanted this song, you know, a man singing to a woman to be a woman singing to a woman. But I didn't want to ask for that because that's so personal.
Right.
And she just delivered it back. And so it takes this song and it changes it quite dramatically, even though not a single word changes. Say
really love that version. I find myself putting that one on repeat a lot.
In the world of what we're now calling Americana, there are more of the singer-songwriter types in that world. And if you are a singer-songwriter, it's almost inevitable that you've spent some time trying to figure out, you know, what is the magic in this potion that Tom Waits has been cooking up for so many years. And he's got such a capacity to get the 90-minute movie into the 3-minute song. So you just had a lot of artists in that world who had their favorite Waits songs. You know, like Patti Griffin's a great example. Ruby's Arms, which I think her version of that is just emotionally stunning.
I will leave behind all of my when I was with you. All I need's my railroad boots and my leather jacket.
She'd been performing that live for a number of years, and man, she was so inside the material, and it just worked out quickly, easily, and her performance, she sure didn't need any notes from me.
And another one I put on repeat a lot is Phoebe Bridgers' version of Georgia Lee, which the first time I heard it, I actually got choked up because of her, like, sorrowful, broken-down voice, very forlorn.
It's devastating.
Yes, that's the word, devastating.
Cold was the night and hard was the ground. They found her in a small grove of trees. Lonesome was the place where Georgia was found. She's too young to be out on the street. Why wasn't God watching? Why wasn't God listening? Why wasn't God there for Georgia Lee?
And again, there, no notes needed from me. That thing came back, and all I had to say was thank you. And I do think something happened again with the lyrics, and it wasn't a case of pronouns. It was a case of, what did this song come to mean coming out of a young woman? Because it's about a young woman. And when Waits sings it, it changes. You know, sometimes I think we forget that a song is not the thing that lives on the paper as words and notes, but a song is the thing that forms in between the listener and the performer. So the listener's context matters, the performer's context matters, and you can't have two people do the same song in the same way. And in the case of Georgia Lee, it was just something happened that, you know, there's a lot of emotion in Waits' version. Phoebe Bridgers identifies it, and then she brings this additional layer of emotion, and it's
yeah,
you know, it just knocked me out.
Definitely, I definitely felt that. And you touched on this a little, basically, about how when two different artists play a cover, it's going to be different. Do you think that there are songs on this album that might be better than the original? Can I ask that?
it's a great question. I don't know if I'm man enough to answer that, because this is ultimately, you know, the number one goal was to wrap up a birthday present and hand it to Tom Waits on his 70th.
Yeah.
That was the whole thing. And just to say, man, we came together as a group to tell you how much you mean to us. And that was the thing. Did any of the performers make a song better? They definitely made it different. You know, Amy Mann doing Hold On versus Tom Waits, it flips some emotional switches that he can't.
Yeah.
I mean, he obviously can do some that Amy can't, but it's not so much, and I'm not doing this just to play it safe.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much thinking about making it better. It's like we go back to the Waits version and hear it with a new resonance, because we just had Amy Mann take us through it.
Yeah.
And we heard new things.
They hung a sign up in our town. If you live it up, you won't live it down. So she left Monterey's son. Just like a bullet leaves a gun.
And when we go back to the Waits version, we can actually apply them. So it's a little bit of this learning about the song. The more teachers you've got on a subject, the better you know it well. The more singers you got on a song, the better you know that song.
So did you have any hand in recording these, or did the musicians just give their versions to you and you just gave the okay?
This is actually a good thing to teach people out in the world. If you want the easiest producer credit in the world, do a multi-artist compilation, because they'll each have their own producers on those tracks. But if you put it together, you get the production credit.
There you go.
The answer is I handed it over to much more qualified people. And there are some great, you know, Brad Jones in particular, I have to isolate, because he's a brilliant player, he's a brilliant engineer, and he's a brilliant producer. And he was kind of my main man, if there was one, in the studio. And he really helped weigh in on all of it. And he produced a number of the things himself. And You know, when I go to make my own records, I often work with Brad because of what he brings to it. And he's a guy who honors the song.
Have you heard from Tom Waits about what he thinks of the album? I mean, you made this for his 70th birthday, so I assume he's heard it.
Yeah, you know, with birthday gifts, and I got kids, so I think about this. How meaningful is it when you say to them, hey, I'm thinking about getting you a puppy for your 13th birthday? If you start having the conversation, by the time the puppy comes, like, who really gives a crap? Yeah, it's cool, but it's not as cool as if suddenly there in the middle of the room, unbeknownst to anyone,
yeah,
is a puppy. You know, so mm-hmm. with this birthday present to Tom Waits, do we go to him and consult, work with him, ask permission, or do we make this present, wrap it, and hand it over when the birthday comes? And we chose the latter. And when the first track was pre-released and it was Patty Griffin's Ruby's Arms, he put it up on his website and on his social media sites. And for me, that was my favorite moment, to have him in that way publicly acknowledge, I see what you kids did.
So do you feel like this album could be a doorway for potential new Tom Waits fans? Because, you know, some people might hear the versions on this compilation and be like, oh, that's so beautiful and stunning. And then they hear the original. And, you know, like you said, it's Tom Waits. It's his gravelly, gritty voice. But maybe, you know, it could cross over.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is not uncommon in, you know, how we take in music. Like, we hear something, and this is one of the best things about us as creatures, is we want to trace it back. So if somebody hears Phoebe Bridgers doing Georgia Lee and looks at the credit, and it's like, oh, she didn't write this, and they start to track it back to Waits, I hope some of that's happening. That's the way we did it growing up. I mean, the Rolling Stones got us to Slim Harpo. And once we got to Slim Harpo, you know, Beatles got us to Arthur Alexander. And once we got there, they took us somewhere else. So it's interesting. We're so ahistorical at times. But as listeners, we're often pretty good about being historical, seeing where it came from, and trying to understand. We may not articulate it as such. So I hope this record does bring people back to this motherload of songs and recordings that Waits has given us.
Thank you so much, Warren Zanes.
Thank you.
The smart money's on Harlow, and the moon is in the street, and the shadow boys are breaking all the laws. And it's east of East St. Louis, and the wind is making
sense. Warren Zanes is a musician, writer, and the producer of Come On Up to the House, Women Sing Waits. He spoke to Beta's senior Tom Waits correspondent, Roz Gryert. You can find out more about Roz, Warren, and the Tom Waits tribute album at WPR.org/beta.
This is an observation I made years and years and years ago about how much Black vernacular is like seeping into these memes being used by really people like all over the world, people of varying cultural backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, racial backgrounds.
White Negroes author Lauren Michelle Jackson on the important role that blackness plays in meme culture. That's coming up in a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Quick, think of one of your favorite memes that you like to use, or maybe just the most popular ones you've seen on social media. Chances are pretty good that they were created or influenced by Black culture. That's one of the arguments that cultural commentator Lauren Michelle Jackson makes in her book, White Negroes, When Cornrows Were in Vogue, and Other Thoughts on Cultural Appropriation. Lauren hopes that the book inspires a public conversation about the co-opting and consumption of Black culture.
I think the way that appropriation gets talked about in the sort of public discourse of it all hasn't been the best and hasn't been really the most precise. So the first line of my book is that appropriation gets a bad rap. And I truly believe that when you sort of look at just the definition of appropriation and really isolate that word, you know, appropriation isn't in and of itself a negative thing. And one of the examples I use is hip hop culture and rap music, which is one of these really beautiful and glorious and really multidimensional genres of music that was able to happen through the confluence of a lot of different cultural influences. So not just Black American culture, as we would call it, but Southern Black American culture, East Coast culture, West Coast culture, culture from the islands, as well as the influence of Latino immigrants on the cross-cultural form and style and presence of that form. And so that kind of appropriation, we don't really even call appropriation because we like it, right? Whereas the forms of appropriation that have the sort of negative stigma attached to them, it's not because it's appropriation, it's because of a disparity in power that we're perceiving when we see somebody like Miley Cyrus, right, getting called edgy because she's doing this thing that Black women have been doing for ages and not getting called edgy or avant-garde or daring or risky, right? They have much more negative characteristics that get attached to Black people when they own their own culture.
Mm-hmm. You explore the career of pop star Christina Aguilera. How does she fit into the history of cultural appropriation?
I thought Christina Aguilera was a really interesting case, and she's sort of the figure that I use for pop music. What I think is really interesting about her is we have someone who is sort of raised on and like comes up through and adopts her vocal style through listening to R&B and funk and sort of old Black pop legends. And so this is someone who didn't just decide to adopt, say, a Black musical sound midway through her career. No, this is someone who is on the Mickey Mouse Club, you know, singing Whitney, singing Toni Braxton, right? But then we have this really interesting moment in the late 90s and early 2000s where, sort of in concert with her trying to develop as an artist who is not a teen pop sensation anymore, but is a young woman and trying to take ownership of her image, is using a different kind of Black sound to sort of escalate her own, you know, sort of adolescence, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm. One of the Christina Aguilera songs that you talk about in your book is her 2006 single, Ain't No Other Man. Give us your take on this song.
You know, this is very much like the post-Dirty period of her career where she is cleaning up, as like a lot of the journalists and music journalists were saying at the time. So she was eschewing the dark, dark tan and the dark, dark hair. She was back to blonde, bouncy curls, red lipstick, really, really playing up this sort of quasi-40s visual aesthetic. And then you have that first single, Ain't No Other Man, which again also has like this sort of 40s vibe, but there's also sort of a 20s vibe. And the video is a sort of mixture of all these old-timey American aesthetics combined with an actual sound that makes use of some 80 samples, 60 samples. You know, it dips into a lot of other different musical sounds as well. And so what I find very interesting about that song is that it's meant to evoke the jazz singers. It's meant to invoke a very A-specific sort of classic, quote-unquote classic American sound that ultimately still ends up being very Black. And elsewhere on that album, she sings tributes to Aretha, to Patti, to, you know, the sort of very classic Black soul singers. But, you know, she gets to sort of make this transition where it feels like she completed, you know, whatever she was trying to work through with the sort of quote-unquote dirty hip-hop era. You know, now she gets to be the mature vocalist on the other side, and it's kind of like her transformation is complete, and you really see that with the success and the sort of critical acclaim of a song like Ain't No Other Man.
Ain't no other man on the planet. That's what you do, what you do. You're the kind of guy a girl
You have this fascinating chapter about memes, and you make the case that Black people are really driving meme culture. How are they doing that?
I think there's like the most like literal interpretation of that, which is that so many memes owe a debt to a certain kind of like Black vernacular to like articulate themselves. So that's sort of like the literal interpretation, and this is an observation I made like years and years and years ago about how much Black vernacular is like seeping into these memes who are being used by really people like all over the world, people of varying cultural backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, racial backgrounds.
Can you give me an example?
Do you remember like the Kermit sipping tea meme? So the reason why the meme was funny and initially came with this tagline, "But that's none of my business," or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, you go to church on Sunday, but be in the club on Friday night, but that's none of my business, or something like that, right? It's like supposed to be revealing like the hypocrisy of the statement. And then you have Kermit from this Lipton commercial sipping tea, which also has a sort of double, an additional valence to it, because, you know, when you sip tea, you know, that's from sort of queer vernacular, particularly from, you know, queer folks of color, meaning to sort of divulge or sort of like shadily divulge secrets and gossip, right?
Mm-hmm.
That meme struck me as like very, very Black, right? But it was not, you know, by no means limited to Black people. And it became very mobile in the sense that now you don't even need that macro text to like convey the sort of sensibility of the meme. You know, you can just have an emoji of a steaming teacup or coffee cup.
Yeah.
Or you could just have the little green frog in the coffee cup, and it sort of translates what the sense of that meme. That's like one example. But like the sort of more abstract and sort of more provocative part of the argument really is that the way that memes circulate and change themselves and sort of reinvent owes such a debt to the way that Black people move and change and reinvent culture. Memes are one form of expression that know that they're sort of subject to be tired out, and so they always have to sort of adapt and change and move. And in the same way that Black culture is so ripe to be taken mainstream and people get sick of it, you know, Black culture also reinvents itself as a means of survival. And so I think in my sort of like abstract-y, linguistic-y argument, that's why I say that memes are super, super Black, you know, formally Black, not just linguistically and not just syntactically.
You say that memes latch onto Black cultural modes of improvisation. Can you explain how they do this?
So you can have memes that will combine themselves or be combined, because, you know, these are people making these things, right?
Yeah.
That will be combined with other memes, and like that becomes another meme and sort of gives life to these two other memes that were like being tired out. You'll see memes sort of cross forms, right? So thinking about the Kermit meme, where, you know, it used to be this image with the macro text, but now can be signified by an emoji or a hashtag, but that's none of my business, you know. So moving from a visual form to a textual form to an emoji form, just all these different ways of being refreshed in new ways that, you know, still have resonance with the old. And so I think about the Nina Simone refrain, which a scholar by the name of Geneva Smitherman talks about as having this really sort of Black tone to it, because she says, you know, it bees that way sometimes, which is like a phrase that still exists today in Black vernacular, even as it presents itself in other ways. Like, it just be like that sometimes, you know, we don't necessarily place emphasis on the bees, right?
So be that way sometimes.
You know, I see that sort of form of cultural survivor, and I see similarities with the way that memes exist and survive as well. And so that's how I say, you know, it's almost like Black vernacular taught memes how to change themselves and how to stay relevant within this really rapidly circulating atmosphere, you know, called online life, called the internet.
Lauren Michelle Jackson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lauren Michelle Jackson teaches at Northwestern University. She's the author of White Negroes, When Cornrows Were in Vogue, and Other Thoughts on Cultural Appropriation. Find out more about Lauren at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Peter Melman, Warren Zanes, and Lauren Michelle Jackson. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to Roz Grier.
She's real. She can bring home the bacon and fry it in the pan.
And that voice!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I once told a woman that I coined the phrase, pardon my French.
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Oh, how could he be so vain?
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
I am loving this yada yada thing. You know, I can gloss over my whole life story.